I welcome you. Thanks for coming out tonight. Good to see you. I hate to break into all this good conversation, but it's my job. So we're glad that you've come out tonight. Thanks for coming out, Walter. Good to see you tonight. And so let's have a word of prayer, and we'll dive into this lesson. Thank you, our Lord, for once again allowing us the opportunity and privilege to gather around your word. And we ask you to send your spirit upon these words of scripture to anoint them to our hearts and to our minds, that we might hear your spirit, that we might be hearers and doers of the word. We pray that this word will be valuable to us as we live this world, in this world, and trod the path that you have set before us. Thank you for this time, for these men who are here. In Christ's name I pray. Amen. Exodus chapter 2. Book of Exodus chapter 2 tonight. We continue our lengthy odyssey through the book of Genesis. Now that we're in the 52nd chapter of the book of Genesis. It only seems like it, right? Yeah. But so we come to Exodus chapter 2, and I've entitled this lesson The Biography of Moses, because if this is in fact Moses' writing, we really should have named it The Autobiography of Moses, right? So I should have called it, but I just called it The Biography of Moses. It's really the primary chapter in the book of Exodus that really talks about Moses himself. The rest of it will be involved in terms of what happens around Moses as the Lord leads him, starting in chapter 3. We learn, first and foremost, that Moses is from the tribe of Levi, because the first verses of the chapter tell us that he was born of a man from the house of Levi who took a Levite woman to be his wife, which is probably not uncommon in that day, where you would marry inside your tribe to maintain the bloodlines. That would probably be considered normal. And it's also important because you remember that it is Moses' brother, Aaron, who will become the start of the Levitical, thus the name, the Levitical priesthood later on. And what's also interesting, if you remember the story of the golden calf, that it is the Levites who rally to Moses' side when he comes down and finds the people worshiping this calf, and he calls out for those who will come to him and stand with him, and it's the Levites who will come to him, and probably because he's one of them, and so they're familiar with him, they treat him as one of their own, so they'll rally to his cause in the midst of that. And it's because of that event, and we'll see it when we get a little later in this book, that that God will grant the Levites the honor of having the priesthood assigned to them. So he's a Levite, born to a Levite mother and father. And in some ways, we talked about this a little bit last week, but in some ways, Moses becomes a prototype. I put that word in scare quotes, because he's somewhat of a prototype of the priests, because he is going to serve at some point along the way as a mediator before God. Remember, the priesthood's primary goal, the primary job of the priest, was to stand between God and the people. That's what priests do. And so, in some ways, Moses becomes the prototypical priest. He's the one who's going to stand in between God and the people. He's the one that's going to mediate for them. He's certainly going to do that in the burning bush incident, when he will come to God and God will send him to the people. It'll be the case when the golden calf event, he will mediate before God for them, even willing to go so far as to, give himself in their place. When he goes back up on the mountain and says, you know, don't kill them off. I mean, I'll take the punishment for him. So he becomes, in many ways, a prototype of the priesthood, which, by the way, is what makes the priesthood of the modern Catholic Church so offensive, because of the fact that they literally are acting in the role of mediators between us and God. But there's only one mediator, and that is the new high priest, who's now seated at the right hand of the Father, Jesus Christ. The book of Hebrews could not be more clear on this subject. And so that is why in Protestant circles we have eschewed all sense of priesthood. We have a priest. His name is Christ. We are called a royal priesthood by Peter because we are mediating this gospel of Christ out to the world, but we are not acting as another Christ. He is the priest and the only priest there. Okay. Now, when this child is born, of course, the edict of Pharaoh is in place. And you remember the edict of Pharaoh was that if a male child is born to a Hebrew woman, toss the child into the Nile. That's the very last verse of chapter 1. So this child being born is a son, of course, and it says he was a fine child. So she hid him for 3 months, and when she could no longer hide him, she puts him in a basket and sets him loose on the Nile. So she disobeys Pharaoh in the sense that she does not toss the child literally into the river for him to drown. And yet at the same time, it could be argued she obeyed him in that she did put him in the Nile. It's just that she didn't sink him in the Nile, which is, of course, the spirit of the law of verse 22, not the letter of the law, right? So in a sense, she obeyed and disobeyed at the same time. Now, of course, as we step back from the story, we know, of course, that God superintended for this to occur in this way. But I would have you to notice something, though. Even though God had sovereignly intended for Moses to be the one through whom the exodus of the people would come, it still required her to take a risk, didn't it? Mm-hmm. It still required her to step out, in a sense. She's not stepping out in some sort of faith that this child is, in fact, a messianic figure. She doesn't know that. There's no evidence in this text that she has any knowledge whatsoever of what Moses' future would be. As far as we can tell from the beginning of this story, he's nothing more than another child that's been born to Israel. And who knows how many women in ancient Israel had tried this stunt, you know, of actually setting their children loose on the Nile in order to save them in some way. We don't know. So I'm not suggesting that in some way that this woman knew inherently what value was going to come in this child. She can't know that. It's not been revealed to her. But what can be known is that she did step out in a sense of great courage, and it was God who used that. And so while we talk about the sovereignty of God over all things, in that God's will be done in all circumstances, we also recognize that God uses ordinary people and their ordinary decisions to accomplish his sovereign will. He doesn't just use miracles. In fact, there's nothing miraculous about this story at all, other than the fact that God superintended what would ultimately happen to her, to him. So I point that out because we need to be very careful as we talk about the sovereignty of God, not to make more out of it than it really is. Sometimes you can get people talking about the sovereignty of God to the point where they say, look, I'm not responsible to do anything. I mean, if God's going to save a people, then he's going to save a people. It doesn't matter what I do. No. God has purposed for us to be the instrument through which the sovereignty of God would act. We are commanded to go into the world and proclaim the gospel to all the nations. So we must be very careful that we don't swing the pendulum too far in the other direction. Let's honor the sovereignty of God. Believe, of course, that he is acting in time and space to accomplish his will, but he's using human means to accomplish it. We must not forget that, which is an example here, I think. Now, it says in verse 5 that the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river while her young women walked beside the river, and she saw the basket amongst the reeds and sent her servant woman, and she took it. When she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the baby was crying. That's an understatement. She took pity on him and said, this is one of the Hebrews' children. Okay? So this basket floats into the general area of Pharaoh's daughter. For some reason, I'm not sure why, the movie The Ten Commandments makes this Pharaoh's sister. Still haven't figured that out yet, but it's Pharaoh's daughter, okay? So it's a princess of Egypt who discovers this child, and she decides to take this child in for herself. And we speculated a little last week as to why this might be. Some possibilities. Maybe she herself is unable to have children of her own and saw this as an opportunity to raise a child. She may have looked at the child and said, yes, I recognize that it's Hebrew, but I don't have any children, and so I'm just going to take this child and raise it for my own. That's a very likely scenario. In fact, it seems to be one of the best explanations for what's going on here. A second possibility is that she disagreed with the edict of the king, noticed that this was a Hebrew child, and used this as an opportunity to defy him in some very real sense, although that's much more unlikely. It's much more unlikely that she would choose to do that. Now, if she did decide to keep the child because she couldn't have children, she's certainly recognizing that she's defying her father in this matter. I mean, she knows the edict of the king, no doubt, because she points out the fact that it's a Hebrew child, so she must have some inkling of the fact that there is an edict over these children. But it's not likely that she's using this as a shake your fist at the Pharaoh kind of moment. Or thirdly, she was afraid of what might happen to the child if it was left in the river and decided it was better to raise the child and let it die. In other words, she had a sense of compassion upon the child and just decided to do something about it. But that again seems also unlikely as well, on the grounds that it would put her not just for a few moments into some sort of danger, but for as long as the child needed to be raised. I mean, after all, if you pluck a child out of the river in order to have compassion on it, you got to have that compassion on it until the child grows up, becomes an adult, and leaves home. And that's not like 3 days. You know, that takes a while. So it's most likely to me, I think, that she simply chooses to do this as an opportunity to raise a child, which appears to be the most likely scenario. And again, the clear message of the text is that God ordained for this woman to act as Moses' surrogate mother. The child certainly floated there, but under the providential hand of God to raise this child. Now, you will notice it says in the midst of this that Moses' sister has been going along the bank, and when the child is taken out of the river, the sister comes to Pharaoh's daughter and says, "Shall I go and call a nurse from the Hebrew women to nurse the child for you?" Well, and that seems like a reasonable thing on the grounds that the Pharaoh's daughter is probably not in a condition at this point to nurse a child. I don't need to do an anatomy lesson here, obviously, but you get the idea. She's not going to be able to do that at this point, so she's going to need someone to do it. And they don't have, you know, you can't just run down to the local Piggly Wiggly and grab some formula in those days. It doesn't really work out that way. So this sister comes and offers this and takes the child back to his natural mother, again, the woman mentioned in verse 1, as the one who would nurse this child until it was weaned. And I asked you this question of how might Moses' mother feel nursing her own son for another woman. And the reason I ask this question is because it's one of those kinds of things that you really ought to be thinking about when you're reading these kind of narratives. What's going on? You know, the text doesn't tell us what she's feeling, and it isn't imperative to any sort of theological understanding per se. But it is an interesting question, which may help to unveil some of the reasons of what goes on in the text. What's going on in the story, I mean. I suspect that the natural mother of Moses would feel a number of conflicting emotions at the same time. On the one hand, she would be very grateful that her son had been rescued and would live. I mean, when she set the child loose on the river, even though she sent the sister of the child along the river to watch, she has no idea what's going to happen to the child. The Nile is a very long river, and that child could have floated for many miles, hundreds of miles, before the basket gave way and the child, you know, fell into the river and drowned. She has no real idea what's going to happen. In many ways, she's certainly hoping that something good will happen to it by putting it into a basket, but she doesn't really know. And so there would be a great sense of gratitude that Pharaoh's daughter, someone, not just Pharaoh's daughter, but someone would actually adopt the child. She might also have a great sense of awe or a great sense of wonderment about the fact that the child had been adopted by a daughter of the king. Now that she wouldn't have expected, right? I mean, the least expected thing would be that a daughter of Pharaoh himself would take the child. Because the more likely reality would be that a daughter of Pharaoh would agree with her father's edict and simply drown the child in the river. So it's somewhat in awe, if you will, of the fact that now her son is being raised by a daughter of Pharaoh. I also think she would have felt a deep sense of sorrow over the fact that the child would not grow up in her own house. Again, I go back to 2:1. A Levite man marries a Levite woman. There's strong tradition here. There's strong cultural and ethnic complementarianism here in the sense of a man and a woman who are both Levites who have a child, and this child is going to go and grow up someplace other than in his own home. She's not going to be able to see him and know him and love him as a mother would love a child. She's not going to have that opportunity. The Pharaoh's daughter is going to do that, and it's highly unlikely. Put yourself in her situation. It's highly unlikely that she would ever see the child again. She's not, as a Hebrew woman, she's not going to have, as a Hebrew slave, she's not going to have access to the Pharaoh's daughter's household, don't you think? Mm-hmm. It's unlikely that she's just going to be able to walk up to the house one day and say, yeah, I'd like to visit my son if you don't mind. That's not going to happen. So she would undoubtedly have a great sense of sorrow that she wouldn't see him again as he went off and is raised by Pharaoh's daughter and fades into Egyptian society. In fact, even potentially a sense of sadness by the fact that he's not going to be raised in a Hebrew environment. He's not going to be raised as a Hebrew. He's going to lose that connection as a Hebrew, as a Semite. Now he's going to be in Pharaoh's household. He's going to have an entirely different lifestyle, completely separated from his own people. He's not going to understand the whole Israelite culture, none of that sort of thing. He's not going to be raised with any of that, except what he might glean from the Hebrew slaves that are in Pharaoh's daughter's household. In some way. I mean, we know in the antebellum South that there were a lot of people who understood, a lot of whites who understood black culture by virtue of being connected to blacks in white households. Same thing would be the case here, potentially. But she's still going to have that sadness of losing that son of hers into an Egyptian background. He's going away from the culture, you know. So there's all these conflicting emotions that she would have felt in the midst of all this as this child now goes off someplace else. And I had you note the parallel between the events here and the events of Matthew 1. And the parallel comes, of course, out of the fact that when Joseph hears of the plot of Herod to kill the children, he runs off to Egypt in order to protect his son. And in some ways, that's kind of the reverse or the mirror image of the edict of Pharaoh, right? Instead of running out of Egypt to escape the Pharaoh, you're running into Egypt to escape a Jewish king, an Israelite king. Okay, so don't miss that irony in the story. But the real reason I wanted you to see the parallel was Joseph is told by Mary that she is pregnant. He doesn't understand this. Remember, I did a sermon on this several, you know, right around Christmas time, talking about the fact that Joseph was, you know, blindsided by this reality. He doesn't know what to do. So what does he do? Well, he decides to divorce this woman who's pregnant, quietly put her away because of the shame that would come upon him and upon her. But God comes to him and says, or an angel comes to him, a messenger of God comes to him and says, no, take the child and raise the child as your own. And notice that Joseph is taking a child that is not his and raising it up. Mm-hmm. Just as Pharaoh's daughter is raising up a child that is not his. And if we're going to take the parallels and stretch them a little, you have Moses who comes to bring a people out, and you have Jesus who comes to bring a people out. There's a foreshadowing, if you will, here. It's light, you know, it's not a great foreshadowing, but it's somewhat there. This idea of somebody that's not your child, that you raise up for the eventual purpose of being used as a redeemer type person is where this is going, I think. Now, go to verse 11, which starts a new paragraph. And it says that one day when Moses had grown up, we don't know how old Moses was. Let's speculate for a moment. If Moses was 40 when he was driven out of Egypt, then it is likely that he's near 40 when these events occur. Okay? Because he spends another 40 years in the Midian wilderness, thus making him about 80 when he returns to Egypt in the days of the Exodus. So these events, the initial events, I should say, of chapter 2, the birth of Moses, are occurring a little after the people have been there about 300 years, right? If we do the math to about 320, right? If we take Paul's 420, then you're looking at more than 300 years, somewhere between 320 and 340 years have elapsed. So this is well into the slavery of Egypt, right? The slavery of the Hebrews in Egypt. Now, when we get to verse 11, then we jump ahead 40 years, basically. So what we have is a gap in between verses 10 and 11, which basically the entirety of Moses' life. Which, by the way, if I might just tangent for just 1 second briefly. Notice here that if indeed Moses is writing this story, which I think he is, he doesn't write anything about his childhood at all. Mm-hmm. Right? Not a thing. Nothing. Because he jumps from his being taken out of the water as an infant to the point where he's now nearly 40 years of age. He doesn't write anything. Why not? Number of reasons could be put. Doesn't think any of it is significant to the story. As he's writing the story, he just says, you know, none of this really matters. Or it could be, and I think a much more likely reality, is that it doesn't really matter. Because even though he was in Egypt and all of those things happened to him, his real focus writing the story here isn't about a place that they have come from, but a place they're going to. In other words, remember the readership of the book. Notice how many times I say this. Think about who's reading the book. Who's reading the book are people who are wandering in the wilderness on their way to Canaan. They have failed to go in like they should have. And so Moses is writing to a people who stubbornly refused to take the land. Now they have to wait till that generation dies off. That takes 40 years. And so then God will bring them in. He's writing to those people. So he says, I don't really need to write anything about all my time in Egypt and all the great fun that I had growing up in Pharaoh's daughter's household and all the things that happened to me there and all that. I don't want to write any of that because it's not important to you. What matters to you is where you're going. You're going to Canaan. So go there. Put Egypt in the rearview mirror. So I think that's why he jumps over. To me, I think that's the most significant reason I would give here. It says that one day when he went out, he had grown up, he went out to his people and he looked on their burdens and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his people. Now, I don't want you to miss that phrase. And he looked on their burdens. He observed it. Now, wouldn't he not have been aware of all of their burdens up to this point? Yes. But what does the phrase probably imply? The phrase to me, and this is open to some debate if you'd like, you'll be wrong, but you could debate me. I think it means that he saw their burdens for the first time, in the sense that he really saw them. Mm-hmm. He begins to appreciate their burdens. He begins to feel a sense of some sort of sympathy. Now, what's my proof for that? Well, the way the story flows out. He looked this way and that, see, no one, he struck down the Egyptian. Why in the world would he do that? If, in fact, he isn't looking at that burden as something unjust. He's seen something unjust for the first time. Now, we must pause here and reflect on the fact that he didn't grow up in an Egyptian home, didn't he? He would have had a great deal of Egyptian baggage. He would have been considered an Egyptian. I mean, in Pharaoh's daughter's household, he would have been quite literally a prince of Egypt. He would have understood all of Egyptian customs. He would have been raised as someone who could read and write. The book itself is proof of that, right? He can write. He understands language. He is capable of understanding all of the Egyptian culture related to their customs, their military abilities, why these Hebrews have been enslaved, and what these Hebrews are doing for them as a people, as this Pharaoh is using them to build up his kingdom. Remember, he's a militaristic Pharaoh. And so he's using them to expand his kingdom, to build what he wants built in order to conquer the world and maintain his position as an emperor. So he has all of that. What would cause him then to strike down an Egyptian? And the only answer you can come up with is that God put it in his heart to see that these burdens that have been laid upon these Egyptians were unjust, that they were wrong. And so now he decides to take matters into his own hands. He strikes the Egyptian. More than anything else, even if we don't want to argue he saw all of Hebrew enslavement as unjust, he saw whatever this particular Egyptian was doing as unjust. Right? This guy right here beating another Hebrew, he decided to take him out. So at a minimum, he's seen something unjust. But it seems more likely that he's seen a greater picture of injustice or injustice there. Okay? Because the next day when he goes out, he sees two Hebrews struggling together, and he says to the man in the wrong, "Why do you strike your companion?" He answered, "Who made you prince and judge over us? Do you mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?" Mm-hmm. Okay, so who are you to tell me what to do? He tries to intervene in the Hebrew scenario, and he gets himself into a situation. Does Moses know his own heritage at this point? Or is he beginning to learn of what his own heritage is? Is this what causes him to see this as an unjust act and the plight of the Israelites as unjust? Is there an injustice there? Don't know. It's possible. I mean, the text says that when he saw the conditions of his people, he was moved to action. It uses his people, right? But again, as we speculated last week, that could just be a rhetorical flourish. It doesn't necessarily mean that Moses knew at the time of his people, but when he's writing this text, he may have said, he saw, he's writing it in second person, right? So he says, he saw the plight of his people. Whether he actually knew at that time or not, it doesn't really, the text doesn't really make it very clear. It is possible that the princes who raised him revealed to him who he really was, but instructed him to remain silent about it until the right time. But we don't really know for sure, do we? We can't really know what ultimately pushes him to act in this way. But what we can know from this text is that it begins now something. And what does it begin? Well, it begins a whole new change to his life. Mm-hmm. It changes everything. Now, it is absolutely unlikely, I think, that Pharaoh would have known about Moses' background. I don't think there's any possibility of that.
That he wouldn't have known.
That he would have known of Moses' background. The Pharaoh probably did not know. Let's put it that way, okay? It's highly unlikely. And the reason why, I think, more than anything else, is when we go back to our understanding of who these kings were, who this Pharaoh was. Remember, he was a Pharaoh who had been part of a dynasty that had driven out the Hyksos kings, the Semite kings. And so he had a natural distaste and hatred for those people who were ruling over Egypt. I don't think he would have allowed for a Hebrew to be in his household as a potential heir to his throne if he would have known that he was a Hyksos.
How would you know, I mean, your daughter, for instance, brings home a baby, well, there in this time,
mm-hmm.
Where did the baby come from?
We speculated.
Question about that.
Yeah, well, we speculated about that last week. One of the answers that we came up with, and I thought it was an excellent one, I think it was Jared that brought it up, is the fact that just because she's Pharaoh's daughter doesn't mean he knows everything that's going on in her household. Because Pharaoh's daughter would not be as important as Pharaoh's son.
Mm-hmm.
Pharaoh's daughter is not in line to the throne, per se, unless he had no other male children. So it could very well be that he doesn't really know what's going on. And if she knows about the edict of the king, the Pharaoh, she would have done everything in her power to prevent him from figuring out the situation in order for him to keep the child. So it seems most likely that this Pharaoh does not know what Moses' background is. And so that's how I would explain the fact that Pharaoh's surprised by what he discovers. And so he puts out an edict to kill him. He issues the edict to have Moses executed, bring him up on charges of murder and have him executed. And I think the reaction is probably more about the revelation of who Moses was, a Hebrew, than it was even about killing an Egyptian. Mm-hmm. You know, I hate to sound glib about this, but, you know, you got to put yourself in a second millennium BC environment. People killing other people goes on all the time. And nobody really cared. You know, I mean, there wasn't a great sense of a great sense of protection and these kinds of things as there are in our day. You know, people die. It's how it happens. Oh, he got killed. Well, he probably deserved it. You know, probably be the response of Pharaoh. So I don't think his putting out an edict to kill Moses because he killed an Egyptian is all that important. I think he finds out he's a Hebrew, and that's why he wants to get rid of him. And as I said, I think he gets rid of him because, or tries to get rid of him because he's deeply angry that a Hebrew could rise to power within his kingdom. Remember, this is the same king that has forgotten about Joseph, right? Those days are gone. The old days of a Hebrew saving the Egyptian people, that's old lore. That's no longer a part of this. This is a militaristic dynasty that has risen up for the purpose of reestablishing itself and taking over the lands of the world. Canaan was a constant incursion location for the Egyptians. They were constantly going into Canaan and taking, conquering peoples in that place because, you know, and we learned, you remember from earlier, from the book of Genesis, that the Egyptians just by nature hated Semites. They thought of them as second-class citizens. So enslaving them is no big deal. So I think that's why, to me, that's why Pharaoh chases him down to try to give him. But what we step back from all this and we're reminded of the fact that once again the sovereign hand of God is at play here. We see the hand of God over the circumstances. We don't see the name of God anywhere mentioned in these chapters. We don't see Moses even writing the text, talk about how God works, except when you get to the last verses of chapter 2. But there's no sense in which Moses writing, well, see, God sovereignly moved me here and God sovereignly moved there. It's implied, and we can look back on the text and see it. But Moses doesn't write it that way. It's simply the way things work themselves out. The good news is that all of that training and all that experience that Moses had as a child in Egypt allowed him to have all the training that he would need to lead a people, write books, all the other stuff that he did. It would give him the training to be able to accomplish all that. So God in his sovereignty is working in the background. Now, if you flip over to Hebrews 11, of course, we call this the great hall of fame of faith, right? Hebrews 11, Moses, of course, is listed as a member of this great hall of fame, and we see him starting in verse 23, and it says, by faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents. So the writer here attributes to Moses' parents a set of faith. But it's more of a faith. It's not a faith in specific promises. It's just a general sense that we're going to trust God with whatever is going to happen to this child. And so they put the child, they hid the child for 3 months because they saw the child was beautiful. And that, by the way, matches what it says in Exodus 2. Moses does brag on himself a little bit there. And they were not afraid of the king's edict. They were not afraid to do this. Then it says in 24, by faith Moses, when he was grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to be mistreated with the people of God than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. So, what the writer of Hebrews does is he gives to us an explanation of what's going on here in Exodus 2. Moses grows up, learns of his heritage in some way. Where, we don't know. How, we don't know. But he learns of his heritage, and he decides, I would rather be identified with these Hebrew people of which I am naturally descended than to be associated or identified with these Egyptians that I'm not naturally descended from. But then it tells us why in verse 20, at the end of verse 25. Choosing to be mistreated with the people of God than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. He considered the reproach of Christ greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward. He weighed in the balance two things. I can stay here with the Egyptians, and I can continue to be a part of their culture, which, by the way, includes all of their polytheistic, paganistic religious forms. Because we know that second century Egyptians were extraordinarily polytheistic and extraordinarily pagan in their religious practices. I mean, they've got gods for everything, right? So he could stay with them. He could continue to enjoy the life that he had in Egypt. He had position, he had upbringing, he had a place in Pharaoh's household. He had all of that as privilege. But coming to know that he belonged to the Hebrews, he said, I'm going to give that up for the reward. For the reward. And that's an interesting phrase. Mm-hmm. What reward?
Eternal life.
Would he even understand that concept at this point? Probably not. Mm-mm. More than likely, the term reward here means what God has promised to the people of Israel. The only reward that we can really come to by the time we get to Exodus chapter 2, the only reward that anyone would have any clue of would be a long, nearly forgotten promise made to Abraham. And I say nearly forgotten. It's not completely forgotten, but it's 300, well, it's more than 300. It's at least 500 years now, more closer to 600 years since the days of Abraham when this promise was made. I'm going to make you, Abraham, into a great nation. I'm going to raise you up into an innumerable people. I'm going to give you a land that's going to be all of your own. And all the nations of the world will bow before you as a people. Now that's a promise. Certainly, if you think about it, the Egyptians were attempting to do that on their own, were they not? Mm-hmm. Using their military power to expand their land and their peoples and so forth. But they weren't always successful at it. They didn't win every battle. They didn't conquer every square inch of the world. And although they had all these polytheistic gods, Moses probably looked at them and went, well, I know what they really are. They're nothing but stone statues because they don't talk. They don't reveal anything. There's no scriptures from them of any kind. There's no revealed word from them. They're mute. They've never spoken. Oh, we have all this lore about what they've said, but we don't have any proof that they actually said these things. But somebody talked to Abraham centuries ago and told him, brought him out of his own homeland and brought him to that place. There's a reward. There's a promise from God. Now, what the writer of Hebrews does is does something anachronistic here that I want you to notice because he can. In verse 26, he says, he considered the reproach of Christ. Mm-hmm. There is no promise of Christ except for a fleeting implication within the promise given to Abraham. And I say fleeting because it hasn't been fleshed out yet. You think about it, the last revelation that God gave about the seed promise was all the way back in the garden. Mm-hmm. There hasn't been any other revelation of this seed promise anywhere else along the way. We read through the entire book, or the entire first 12 chapters, right, of the book of Genesis, up to that great promise, and there's nothing there about a Messiah. There's a hint of it, because there's always been that seed promise embedded in the protoevangelion of Genesis 3:15. But there's no sense that that has been fleshed out in any sense here at all. But the writer inserts it here, because there's enough, apparently, of understanding for Moses to be able to say, I would rather trust in the God of Abraham than the God of these Egyptians. Mm-hmm. And I have no idea exactly what that promise means, other than it has something to do with something coming, someone coming in the future in some way. He's making a decision, if you will, about following Christ. I'm going to put that in quotes, because there's no following Christ in the 1400s BC, but he's decided to follow Christ, even though he has very little knowledge of this Christ. The writer of Hebrews, in fact, is really sort of telling us underneath this that the reason for this is not of him, but of God. Mm-hmm. It's not of him, but of God. There's no way Moses could make a decision to follow after Christ, because there's no revelation of that yet. The only possibility for why Moses would repudiate his Egyptian background and decide to stay with these enslaved Hebrews is because he believed that promise, that long ancient promise to these people in some way. And let's not forget something else. When Moses decides to repudiate this background, when he decides to repudiate his Egyptian background, what does he think the rest of his life will be?
Terrible.
He thinks the rest of his life will be enslavement.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't have any clue that he's been set aside as the one who will meet with God at a bush and God will commission him to go and lead the people. He has no clue of that. None of that is here. All he knows at this moment is that he was rescued from the river by Pharaoh's daughter. He's learned about this heritage that he actually belongs to, what his real ethnicity is. And he knows a little of what these people now know of that ancient promise of God. But that's all he knows. That's it. So he's repudiating a pagan environment in order to follow after a promise of God that he knows almost nothing about. Now let me point out something to you if you haven't noticed the irony of that. We live in a day in which there is more known about the promise of God than there's ever been in human history. All of what God is going to do in time and space has been made known to us. And yet, we still live in a time when people reject it. We have an opportunity to believe in a far greater revelation than Moses had. Moses chose to walk away from the paganism and all the blessings of being an Egyptian and all of what he could possibly have become, to become a slave. And we are asked to do exactly the same thing, but with far greater revelation. Mm-hmm. We're asked to repudiate the world. We're asked to walk away from the paganism. We're asked to trust in this Christ, the reproach of Christ, to follow after this Jesus. See it? See the importance of this? You've been given this massive revelation. This is why Jesus could say when he was preaching in his public ministry, on the day of judgment, those at Sodom and Gomorrah would stand up and judge the people of Tyre and Capernaum. Why? Tyre and Sidon. Why? Because they had so little revelation, and yet the people of Tyre and Sidon had massive revelation. The responsibility ratchets up the more you know. The more God is revealed, the more you are responsible to embrace it and follow it. And so in our day, as those who claim to be followers of Christ, we have absolutely no excuse, none, for not knowing who this Christ is and what he has accomplished and to follow after him in absolute allegiance. Moses was willing to give up everything to follow this Christ. What are we willing to give up in the face of overwhelming revelation that has come to us? You see it? We got no excuse. None. So he believed in a promise made to Abraham that all the nations of the world would be blessed through him. And the writer of Hebrews, writing, 1,400 years later, interprets that for us. This Moses understood. This Moses was called to faith in this God. Let's go back to that comment about age of Moses. Okay, go to verse 15. When Pharaoh heard of it, when he heard that Moses had killed the Egyptian, he sought to kill Moses. Moses fled from Pharaoh and stayed in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. Okay, now notice another paragraph begins in verse 16. Okay, so another paragraph of his life. All right, so he's fled away from Egypt to get away from Moses, to get away from Pharaoh's edict. And so now he comes to this place in Midian. And he comes here. Now, we speculated, I said, that Moses was about 40 years old when he left Egypt, and he stays in Midian for about 40 years. So everything from verse 16 to verse 25 of this chapter encompasses about 40 years. Everything from verse 1 to verse 15 covers 40 years. So Moses is going through his biography quickly, just getting it passed, just so we have some idea of what's going on. We learn a few things about what happens to him there. He marries a woman by the name of Zipporah. He has a child by the name of Gershom. He becomes a Midianite. He's part of his father-in-law's household here, so he becomes a shepherd in that place, and so he starts a whole new lifestyle, if you will, and a whole new ethnicity, living in the Midian wilderness. So he's there. But I wanted you to notice this, that a third of Moses' life was a period of basic training. A third of his life was a period of continuing training, and a third of his life is actually the task. So he spends two-thirds of his life getting prepared before he actually goes back into Egypt. So the first 40 years and the second 40 years are necessary for the Exodus. And I had you compare this to two other events in the New Testament, Matthew 4 and Galatians 1. In Matthew 4, we learn that Jesus is about 30 or so years of age when he leaves home and begins his public ministry. But the very first thing that happens is he goes off to the wilderness and he spends 40 days in the wilderness. And in that 40 days, he's being tempted by the devil. We get one account of it recorded in Matthew 4. I suspect Jesus is constantly under the attack of the devil during that 40 days. But he's being prepared. So he comes out of 30 years of living under his father's household, being a carpenter, working, like I said this morning. And that's that preparation time, that initial preparation time. Then 40 days of violent attack by the devil, which would give him the spiritual preparation that he would need, quote unquote, as the Son of God, and then to actually go off and begin to minister. It's a phase. It's another phase in his life that would be necessary. Same is true of Paul. Paul alludes in Galatians 1 to the fact that after he was converted on his Damascus Road experience, he goes to the church at Antioch, and when he gets there, he is sent by that church back home. It says he goes off to the Arabian Desert, but where he goes is to the southeast corner of Turkey, which is where Tarsus is at. And he winds up spending what we think are about 14 years in Tarsus. And what's he doing there? What's he doing for 14 years in Tarsus? And the answer is he is unlearning all those years of Judaism. And I say unlearning in the sense that he's going, let me see now, see if I got this right. We have an entire Bible filled with Jewish history and customs and feasts and sacrifices and temples and priesthoods and all this other stuff. How does Jesus fit into all that? How does Jesus fit into all of that? And I think that's what those 14 years are. Him unlearning himself as a Pharisee and a rabbi and coming back out at the end of 14 years and going, I understand how all of this fits together through all of this. He could take out any of the books of the Old Testament at this point and say, let me show you how Christ fits into this particular chapter. He could do what we did for so many weeks in Genesis, right? Take every chapter and I can show you from the chapter how the gospel of Jesus appears, where Jesus is at. He went back and read Isaiah 53 and all the other passages and said, I see how this fits. He put his Judaism together with Christ. And by the way, the reason I'm convinced that's true is because the book of Galatians is the very first letter that Paul wrote. After he comes out on his missionary journeys, right, his first missionary journeys, he immediately sends back a letter to the churches at Galatia, Lystra, Iconia, Derbe, Antioch, Pisidia, all in Central Asia Minor, otherwise known as the province of Galatia. He writes this letter back there, and what's his primary, what does he do? He excoriates the Galatians for abandoning justification by faith alone. Mm-hmm. The primary topic that he's come to understand in his understanding of Christ as it fits into the Old Testament. He goes, I've come to understand that for the last 1,400 years, we Jews have gotten this wrong. We've been thinking we could be justified by the law, by keeping the law. We can't. We can only be justified by faith in this Christ, who God had foreshadowed in everything, and we should have seen it. We didn't. We should have. And so now he writes to the Galatians and says, how quickly you're abandoning what I taught you. It really made him mad. He's anathematizing them at one point, isn't he? Cursing them for doing this. This is why I'm convinced that this is the case. He's just come out of 14 years of learning this stuff. He's excited about going into the central part of Turkey, modern-day Turkey, and preaching the gospel to a people of justification by faith alone. And then as soon as he leaves, they're up back to Judaism again. You almost can see him go, oi. So it's a period of training for Paul. He needed a period of training. Moses needed a period of training. In Moses' case, it took 80 years of training. In Paul's case, it took 14 years. In Jesus' case, it only took 40 days, plus 30 years. So it takes a while. That's okay. Training is what is necessary. It's what you got to have in order to do this work. And by the way, just let me point out that these are just, other than Christ, of course, these are ordinary men, right? Mm-hmm. And what are they doing? They're learning, they're growing, they're understanding these things. We are all called to be learners. In case you aren't aware of it, the word disciple means learner. It means the follower of a rabbi. As a disciple, go and make professors of Jesus.
Disciples.
No, it doesn't say that.
No.
It says go and make disciples. Jesus says go and make learners of all nations and teach them everything I have commanded you. That's what we're supposed to be doing. I don't buy this modern idea that you can go to the church and never learn something. If you're going to a church and you're not learning something, you are wasting your time because you're not a disciple. You must be learning something. There should be something new that you're discovering from the Word of God every time you open it. What is this Word saying to me? Who is this God? What has this God done? Who is this Christ? What has he done? This is what it's all about. So I have you notice that, because even Moses needed time to understand this and be prepared before he would meet God in the bush. Very end of the chapter, in verse 23, it says, during those many days, the king of Egypt died, and the people of Israel groaned because of their slavery and cried out for help. Their cry for rescue from slavery came up to God, and God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. Now, those two verses are summary verses, okay? They don't really have anything to do with Moses, per se. They're just summary verses. The people of Israel are still languishing in their slavery. Moses is off in Midian, doing his shepherd thing out there. The people back in Egypt are still groaning under the weight of their slavery. The king dies, but another king rises up right behind him. Remember, I gave you a list of the kings in the first lesson of who's there. So Amos the second is followed by somebody else. Amos the third, for all I know, for all I remember. Somebody's coming along. But the cry goes out from the people. And then this interesting phrase in verse 25. God saw the people of Israel, and God knew. You see that? The way that's rendered? It's very interesting. And God knew. Doesn't God know everything all the time? I mean, isn't God omniscient to know all that there is to know? And all that there is not to know as well? I mean, we believe God is omniscient in the sense that he knows everything that can be known, as well as everything that isn't known. God knows what is and what is not. Because he knows you wore that shirt, but you could have worn a different one. And he knows all the other shirts you could have worn. And all the other possible decisions you could have made. So God not only knows what is, but he knows what is not as well. So what does it mean God knew? Is it like all of a sudden God went, oh man, I forgot about those people. No. I think what it means is that God knows in that he is now ready to enact the plan to get these people out of that slavery. He knows in the sense that he now is going to bring to fruition what he's going to do. He knows not in a passive sense of simply hearing the cry of the people and deciding to act. No, he knows because his plan to rescue them is just one step on the long road of him building a nation through which his son would come. This is just another step on the long path from Abraham to Christ. It's one more event that God himself knows about. God acts by virtue of the fact that he knows. His knowledge is active in the world. What he knows comes to fruition. Why? Because he knows it. This is a key concept of theology. God is not passive in his knowledge, ever. What God knows, he knows because it is. It is it, and it is because he knows it. It is real because he knows it. You and I have passive knowledge. We can know something to be true. It doesn't affect anything just because we know it. I can know that this table has substance, but it doesn't change the table just because I know it. But God knows that the table has substance. Why? Because his knowledge makes it so. Now, that's a really difficult concept for us to get our minds around, but we must keep our minds around that if we think about who God is and what he does. I would put it this way. God does not know just by looking through the corridors of time who is going to be his people. As though he just passively takes in knowledge. Oh, I see Anthony is going to profess faith. Oh, okay, I see. Okay, yes, now I know that. Uh-uh. God knows who will believe, which means they believe. They will believe in time and space from our perspective. From his perspective, in which he has no such thing as time, right? Because he lives in the eternal present. When God knows it, it is. Because God always knows it. And therefore it is. See, so those who want to argue that God is some sort of passive taker on of knowledge, which, by the way, most non-Reformed theology ultimately comes to, it becomes this idea of some sort of passive sense in which God takes in knowledge. But if God is taking in knowledge and discovering things, then God's not God. Mm-hmm. Because God cannot learn, because that would imply that there's something outside of God's viewpoint, God's understanding. No, God knows, which means it comes to pass because he knows it. So when he knows a people from before the foundation of the world and writes their name in the Lamb's Book of Life, that is an active knowledge that means absolutely and beyond a shadow of a doubt, they will be his for all eternity. And the process in time of Christ coming, and then the Spirit being sent, and them coming to faith, and them growing in that faith, and passing into glory, and living with him in eternity. For us, that's a line of time. For God, that's one thing. One instantaneous idea in the mind of God. See? And God knew. He knew what he was going to do. Because he'd always known it. Because it was part of his character to know it. All right, so we have now established Moses where he is now ready to be called by this God. So your next lesson will take you to Exodus chapter 3. And from there we will begin, and you'll be also be going into chapter 4, as it turns out, as we see Moses getting his initial call to this plan of God. All right, so now we know who the man is going to be and what his biography is, so we will continue on with his life as we go.